what a good idea, Glenn, to recast and to update Morris in that way, giving us lots of food for thought, quite definitely. So we'll throw it open to people to for questions and discussion now. George, yes, you are.
Yeah, I don't want to rubbish the book because I think it's wonderful. But it's only 30 years or so before women's suffrage, and the portrayal of women is so antiquated in the book. You know, if I remember it rightly, it's books and wenches serving tankards of beer and that sort of thing. And also, I mean, the Brotherhood were really sort of misogynistic. Just wondered if you wanted to address that point at all.
Yeah, I did allude to that, of course, in perhaps too much of a light-hearted way, but I think we wouldn't find that acceptable now, of course, but I think we have to put ourselves back in the time. You know, this was a long, long time ago, and hopefully, well, thankfully, a lot of has moved on, particularly in terms of women's rights and so on. But my own view is, even now, I think women are still second-class citizens, or viewed by the second-class citizens by society, and that's pretty evident everywhere still. So, in simple terms, I guess that, you know, the only way of getting rid of that is again same answer, isn't it? It's getting rid of a society that forces you know, women into those positions.
I think what surprised me though, Glenn, was that it's so the period between the writing of the book and women's suffrage is so short that it seems so very, very blinkered as a view. I mean, women were fighting then for rights, the vote, etc. You know, it's only 30-odd years, really.
It's a very short space of time, yeah. I'm not sure if anyone else feels able to comment on that. I mean, I'm not a historian, certainly not a historian of that time, by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. Does anyone else feel able, better qualified to comment on that? Because I don't feel able.
Rob? I'm not qualified either, but I think you can say the same thing today for the position of many, if not all, women.
Well, you could also say, actually, you've got, obviously, a little earlier, of course, Wilberforce and slavery, you know, slavery wasn't abolished, it's still going on. And I suppose you could take a similar viewpoint, you know, women's lives are equally as dreadful in parts of the world, the Middle East and so on. And, of course, slavery still goes on. So this idea that slavery suddenly disappeared, yes, it was alleviated, but it didn't go. Again, another symptom of a system that sort of forces that sort of thing on people. I'm not sure I've been very helpful in.
No, I think the point I was trying to make, or not trying to make, or not making, was that he's so prescient in so many other ways, and yet the position of women remains so antiquated. You know, he's got this amazing vision that even now, 2021, whatever it is, we can't get across to people. It seems absurd. And yet he was making that point then. And yet the position of women was so incredibly antiquated in his view.
Mm.
I think that's the point of
I think you just have to see him in his time. I mean, we're all subject of our times, aren't we? And how we, you know, I mean, I have to be honest with you, even when I was a kiddie at school, I mean, I'm, you know, mid-60s now. I must have only been 8 or 9 or 10. Racism at primary school was right.
Oh, don't
tell me.
Unbelievably. Yeah.
And, you know, it was to make a joke about someone with dark skin was commonplace and thought nothing of. I mean, you've only got television programmes like sort of Love Thy Neighbour or, you know, that sort of thing. You know, it was. So things do change. And I think we've got to be mindful of that.
I just want to comment. I think you make a good point. The point you make as well. What's your name?
Joy.
Joy, I think you're making a good point. Like what you're getting at is that he's so forward-thinking in other regards, and this is a time when I mean, there was an early flowering of feminism in the late 19th century. So how come he wasn't onto that? And I'm going to speak here knowing nothing about it, but I wonder whether that might have had something to do with the way things were in the pre-Raphaelite movement, you know, where they kind of idealised these Burne Jones and all that, all the people.
Yeah, that was the point I was trying to make as well, yeah.
Yeah.
That is a good point, though, isn't it? Yeah. The pre-Raphaelite movement did, you know, the women were portrayed as being these sort of sylph-like, fairy-like creatures that sort of floated around.
Sorry, I refer to them as the Brotherhood. I don't know whether I made the point that was the same.
Yeah, they were the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood that were actually called that.
Yeah, yeah.
They were very insistent on being called the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, not the Pre-Raphaelite Brother and Sisterhood.
I feel slightly forgiving towards them, I must say, not because, of some sort of dreadful misogynistic kind of viewpoint, but more, they were their time. I mean, 10 years ago, you had golf clubs that would not have women in. I mean, so it's not as if they were so, you know, they were of their time, you know.
Bill?
Well, I think because the book was published in serial form, and I think he took flak for it at the time, which is why later on I think you get the woman foreman of the Obstinate Resistors, who are building the bridge rather than going out and collecting the crops. And I think also his depiction, if I recall, of the couple, it's the woman who has the affair. And so there's this element of sexual liberation. So I wouldn't go very far defending him, because obviously, the bits with the women that they're, waiting happily at the tables is just toe-curling. But I think in the context of that he was taking part in live debates, rather than, and say this was just his own view, particularly as he makes clear in the first chapter about, six people in the room, therefore six visions of socialism. It needs to be read as part of a debate in its time, rather than as a completed novel from start to finish.
That's a good point. He also does, I didn't mention this, but there's a woman stonemason in the book as well, which at the time would have been a fairly male occupation. And in fact, there's half a dozen women stonemasons who are putting together this big building and bashing away with chisels. So to be fair to him, I don't think he sees women as being these sort of pretty little things in dresses skipping through meadows picking flowers. I think he does give them another persona as well.
Richard,
just a little point for me. I was thinking, we all have our blind spots. Think about Morris and he's written about women. And this came to me, my great love of classical music, I went to the Albert Hall to see a concert given by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. This would be in the mid-80s. And during it, or at the end, so I said to my girlfriend at the time, said, there's no women in that orchestra at all. And I said, is that right? And I had the programme, I read through all the names, they were all foreign names. I thought, oh, there's not. And later on, I found out it was newsworthy that the Vienna Philharmonic were going to admit women for the first time. I think this happened in the 1990s. They've now got quite a few women. But I thought, there's my blind spot, because I've never really noticed, and I could see them playing, that they were all men. And also, it never even crossed my mind at the time that they were all men and there was anything odd about them. Mm.
Good point.
Yeah. It's only when it was pointed out by a woman, I thought, maybe that's a bit strange when there's dozens of them.
I think.
But there was actually a rule that women could not play in that orchestra until sometime in the 1990s.
I think that's interesting. I mean, funny enough, women were that was the pursuit of wealthy young women, playing harp and sort of needlework and stuff. Once they did involve themselves in music. They didn't, but I think an interesting thought. I mean, what I find it interesting is that if you there was talk. Richard yesterday mentioned hunter-gatherer societies, and. I've also, as some of you aware, I've spent a great deal of time up in the Arctic living with the Inuit in parts of Canada and Greenland. And those societies, not so much now, but certainly the elders and so on, and a few of them still live in such a way that the male and female role in their lives is very prescribed. So what you don't get is this sort of what you might want and get now to a greater degree in our lives, where men and women's careers cross over and so on. You don't get that. So in other words, the man is the hunter, the woman is the person that prepares the skins and looks after the nightlife and so on and so forth, and does the sewing, puts the skins on the kayaks and all these things. The man looks after the dogs, and they have absolutely separate roles, so much so that it would be very difficult for either one to live without the other. Very specific roles. And actually, even in the UK, you don't have to go back very far to find that in rural and early life in the UK. Even, I mentioned fishing, that's a good example. If you go back only 150 years, a fisherman living in a town in Foy, Mevagissey, or you know, anywhere on the sort of Cornish, Devonshire coast, couldn't survive without a woman there doing basically doing what a woman does. The Welsh mining town is rather similar. So that kind of understandable and mixing of the roles of men and women in terms of careers, I think, is very, very recent. But there may well be reasons that aren't abhorrent in a way as to why they weren't women in orchestras or something, because it was a throwback from the past where there were very set ways of doing things.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed your story, as well as obviously William Morris' one, but you didn't have any mention of like the welfare system, and I mean you said about charities, and obviously it is supposed to sound a very bleak portrayal of how life is now, but I think there are some kind of like chinks of positivity and kind of kindness and whatever, and justice, and you know, looking after each other, as in, you know, that not just people begging at the street side, but you know, people can go to claim benefits, and you know, if they're sick and whatever, and, you know, you didn't mention anything about that, and I just wondered what.
There's an awful lot I didn't obviously mention. I mean, yeah. It was only a kind of little snapshot. I think I said to earlier on that to really, I think what might be an interesting project would be to kind of rewrite that in its entirety. So you rather like Morris, he had chapters that were how he did deal with all the facets you're talking about, really, or the facet you're talking about, as well as many others. And so he addressed how different things would be done, but there's simply not time in the time we have to do that.
In your story,
yes, but I mean, I could have done so many issues in that. You see, I mean, if there was is there anything that interests you? Any specific thing that you think you feel you'd like to mention about the welfare system that we could talk about as a group here? I don't know.
No, I suppose not really. It's just that you know, at times, you know, and I resonate with everything that you said and whatever, but God, it, you know, kind of looking at it very objectively, it's grim, isn't it? You know, what you're saying about the capitalist society.
Well, it is.
But yeah, and I get that, but, you know, there are some, like I said, some kind of sways
Okay, I'll address it. Let me just briefly, because, I mean, I don't want to sort of carry on talking too much, but I, for my sins, I teach stone carving, and I teach to and one of the classes is for people with learning difficulties, and that is the sort of group that in our society is being hopefully helped and benefited in the way that you're alluding to, but their funds. I know this because I'm talking to them. They have a young woman that brings them along. They live in a sort of housing association, kind of sheltered flats, and she brings them along, and I talk to her and I talk to them obviously while they're doing their stone carving, and the funds are being massively withdrawn. If a member of staff leaves, she has to take on all of that responsibility for the person that's left. The pressure on her is huge. She can barely sleep at night, she struggles to sleep, and she does a wonderful job, but, you know, don't have too much of a romantic view about what our benefit system is like. I have another friend who works with refugees that come into the country. People that are in caring for people at home. So they're unpaid carers. They can get some money, and she tells me she has to interview them. And she said the way she describes their how they have to talk about their financial details to get a scrimpy bit of money in order to get a bit of food is demeaning to the point of being awful. And believe me, no money you get for nothing from the society is easy to get, and boy, do they make you feel like you, no, you know.
And I understand that, Glenn, because I work in adult health and social care as well, so, mm-hmm. you know, I work with people that, you know, you're mentioning, but I know that, you know, in my mind there is no benefit to being on benefits, so I agree with that, but I also work with some people who are actually getting more money coming into their pockets than I am per month from actually holding down a full-time job.
And who are on benefit?
Who are on benefits, who are on universal credit, PIP, you know, pretty much everything. They seem to know what they can get, and, you know, they know the
language. I can sense a bit of resentment coming in here, but can I,
No, because I wouldn't, you know, that's not for me, but I can assure you that that is the case. Yeah. There are people who are on all of
that. But can I just say to that, there are some sort of dreadful newspapers that put on, you know, their front page, you know, something like, oh, woman with claiming disability but seen at the gym and claiming an extra 25 quid a week or something, and she's vilified for that and made, you know, and basically it's working people being set against other workers. Yeah. What about Jacob Rees-Mogg? Who complains about these people that have these massive offshores, so, you know, creaming money in for arms companies or something, you know? We've got to be careful about how we deal with each other, I think, really.
Okay. Can we move on? I mean, I think what you're saying basically is that things aren't quite so bad as perhaps Glyn made out were under capitalism, and that, you know, capitalism does, you know, give a lot of people a sort of basic, you know, a way to live basically anyway, and you know, things aren't quite so grim as we sometimes make out, and I think that's absolutely true actually.
I have to say that between getting off the train and getting a taxi yesterday, I emptied my pockets.
Okay, so that's well to everybody. Okay. Sibeli, I think it's you next. You had your hand up.
Then after Fred, you want to show
We have people in the speaking queue as well, so do you, do you want to contribute?
Yes, I would like to. I actually, you said the word romantic, and I'm a great fan of the William Morris and Arts and Crafts movement. And this is a bit of romantic, but I totally understand where your point goes, because this is a time of struggle at the time. Done some research on his works, and is you have to understand, as you said, the vote was not available, and the work at home was a very important one the Industrial Revolution was trying to get things done. But one thing I really like about the movement is exactly the point that when the women, even though this is not, I don't know, I haven't read the book, News from Nowhere, but the women was more centered on the home kind, on the arts and crafts movement, when the house, Art Deco, when the house would be the place for people enjoy and appreciate life. So, and when the men was, of course, sent to really atrocious works like mines and factories, and all the arts and crafts movements, the textile, which happened, and the painting. That's a really hard work. So that's why it got the separation between this really active and vibrant kind of movement, when the women's suffragettes try to get their way out, and men of them end up going to work and not looking after the house, and children start to work at the period. So it's a very grim kind of period, but I think it's very inspiring, because that's when we got some beautiful kind of war arts of war and architecture. So that's why I find that period very interesting for our history and understand socialism and what capitalism was becoming without counting the slavery mentality was at that point. So I just want to make this comment that is looks like the women are like not on the scene of this period, but women are really there, and we have to remember women wasn't allowed to go to universities because they didn't have a property. There was a problem exactly there. It's the property and the access to it and how to make a life which is a standard for good living. So it's a very crazy moment. I find interesting. And looks, there's that book there, looks, I think I read some parts of that. And when they make the march, then people come from all parts of the countries and meet here to those factory things. So it's a very, I think, I just would like to add that women was on the scene, but of course men is gonna do their ways and describe, but it's got the blend, which I think is still important for us to have a look at it and find the inspiring way of, we divide the work labor in a way. Yeah, because some women don't want to work in some place, and men as well, so it just makes a bit more like romantic.
Thank you.
Freddie, I've got you on the list, but can we bring in Moggy, who's in the speaking queue first, all the way from New Zealand? Moggy?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, yeah.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. I'm a big fan of William Morris. And I believe that things should be beautiful as well as functional. There's a lot of things now that we have to put up with, things that are dirty and ugly, because that is considered the norm. And just for example, 40, 50 years ago, I used to almost have a phobia about going shopping in town because I didn't want to walk on dirty little pavements that look like ashtrays. People, horrible smokers, used to think that it's their right to really strike a match and then throw it, or to put a cigarette on the ground and stuff it out more when they need it. And cities used to be dirty. Even the beach, if you went to the beach, it's hard to find a clean bit of sand on the beach because of so much rubbish. Things are much better now, probably because there are people who smoke, but people are conscious now, keeping the pavements and beaches nice and clean. Another thing, when you go out to a concert, rather than just sitting, listening to music, it's nice to have a beautiful atmosphere. I don't know whether any of you lucky enough to go to an Andre Rieu concert, but that is absolutely marvellous because the musicians are beautiful to look at as well as to listen to. The ladies wear beautiful silk dresses, the men are beautifully dressed, and they don't just use ordinary music stands, they have beautiful tie-in music stands. In front of the stage there is a beautiful display, the whole presentation is lovely. And now there's a trend going back to, at the time cinemas became rather rocky places, but now people are going back to the little boutique cinemas. Back to the Art Deco days of when cinemas were called picture houses. And it's beautiful, so you have beautiful surroundings, and I think it's nice to appreciate the beautiful things as well as being functional. And okay, it's expensive to do things this way, but of course in a socialist society it will be expensive, that might be considered the norm. So that's my thoughts on it. Thank you.
Thanks, Moggy.
Thank you. Good point.
I think we need to move to New Zealand.
Exactly. What street is she talking about?
Okay, Freddie.
I'd like to say, Glenn, I found a little story at the end. It's a little story, but the story at the end there, quite inspiring, really. Now, you know, I didn't intend saying anything, so I'll try and be as brief as possible. Capitalism is grim. Let's make no mistake about it. It is utterly grim. Yeah, there's so maybe it's given us a world of abundance, but capitalism is grim. There's no two ways from it. And one of the things that I also feel the need to comment on was this one about people on universal credit are some people who receive benefits and are getting more in benefits than what some workers do that are employed by employers. I think I need to comment on that. Those that can do that, I say bloody good luck to them. That's what I think. If they can do that, good luck to them. And I'll tell you why I say that. I do HR consultancy work, and only this week on Thursday, I was in the job centre in Doncaster interviewing people on universal credit, interviewing them, because the government has currently got a scheme going where they will pay the employer money to take on people on universal credit, and those individuals that I met on Thursday, they're sent there by the work coach. That's what they're called. They're called work coaches. You go there, you either try and get a job or else you get no benefit. I know there may be one or two get more money than what they would in employment. That's because most of them, to the best of my knowledge, have got pretty low skills. So they'd get maybe the national minimum wage anyway. I beg your pardon. So as I say, I mean, for me, people on universal credit, etc., those that are getting it, it's not, the streets are not bloody paved with gold for them, I can tell you that. And just to finalise, I would say this also, that your story at the end there, Glenn, I'd suggest, if it's not already thought of, something like that went to social standard, particularly for the uninitiated. Because as interesting and as wonderful as Karl Marx is, etc., that sort of thing, I think, would strike a chord. Hold on, Denise. I'm actually getting nervous now. Would strike a chord with new readers, etc. I think it would be a brilliant article. Even, maybe one or two bits, like the benefit system, not mentioned. That could be your follow-up. I think that was a brilliant story, and I think if it's not already considered, some thought be given to that going into the standard. Thank you.
I had the same idea, I must say.
Very briefly. Thanks, Freddie. I'm trying to widen the door frame to allow myself out. My head's got bigger. What I would say, I agree with you, Freddie, on the and your comments about these issues with benefits and so on. I think one thing we have to be really careful of, all of us, and I don't think we generally don't fall foul of it, but it's so easy to be criticised, if you like, your fellow working person. And I think we've really got to be careful of that, because capitalism is very good, really good, at making people think that the problem is their fellow workers. It's very good at that. So the current migrant situation is entirely around, oh, these people, you know, there's this background white noise of they're going to take your jobs and they're going to do this, they're going to live, you know, they're going to stop you getting this, that, or the other. It's bloody cleverly done, and, you know, hats off to capitalism for how good it is at that. And it will very quickly turn working person on working person, really quickly and really easily do that. So much so as well that on the contrary also happens. So I remember John Humphreys when he was on Radio 4, and this was when the first waves of these desperately poor people coming across the Mediterranean. This was the Mediterranean, not the Channel. And I think I've said this at a socialist meeting before, but I found it so appalling. The people that were pushing them into the boats and taking what little money they had and jamming them without life jackets into boats and then sending them off on the most dangerous imaginable journey were being referred to as businessmen. And that kind of gave it a weird legitimacy. It was, as long as they were about making money, they were sort of okay, you know. They weren't called what they were, you know, which was diabolical, but... even those awful people that were sending people across the Mediterranean or as now the Channel, running businesses to get money, even though we could think of them as being utterly evil and utterly dreadful, without capitalism, why would they do that? They're only doing it for one thing, money. And so even those people, in a weird way, you could almost forgive. Because they're doing it like anyone would do anything for money. It's almost excused. Sorry, Al, thanks. A bit too long an answer.
Okay, sorry.
Mike, I just want to say that I don't want people... There were women in the pre-Raphaelite movement. Women are good painters. I think some people might walk away from this thinking it are all men. There was a woman called Evelyn de Morgan, a well-known painter. Her works are brilliant. So, you know, it's just a little comment I want to make because I think some people could walk away thinking that they were all men, and that's not true. There were quite a few women in there as well, and they were good artists. That's all.
Mike, did you want to say something?
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Glenn. I enjoyed that. I just wondered if something you sort of touched on, I was wondering if you could expand on it a bit more. But with... William Morris's other sort of line of work with his wallpaper designs and his sort of artistic side, and maybe your own sort of skill in sculpture. I was just wondering what your thoughts were, both for yourself and maybe what Morris said in News from Nowhere about how sort of art could flourish in a socialist society, and how art might be viewed in a different way in the future to how it is now. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on art in the future.
And you know, I've often thought about that, and it's quite an interesting thought, really. I mean, Morris's work, as you all know, I'm sure, was heavily involved with design, and he drew heavily from nature, of course. And I think for someone like Morris, a socialist society and the creation of aesthetic and art would be no problem. But it might be a problem for me because nearly everything I do is sort of kind of slightly reactionary or questioning society, in art, I mean, in the sculpture I do, and it's dealing with environmental issues and so on. So if everything was all wonderful, you do kind of what you might end up doing, I must say. So I think that, of course, there would be a place for it, but I think Morris's view, take on it, as you all know, really, I don't have to spell this one out, is... I think someone mentioned about form and function and things being beautiful as well as functional. And that was the key thing, wasn't it, of course? And I think that is the great, you know, the great wonder, the great spectacular thing that could come out of a new socialism or a new socialism. You know, things that were produced would be made, and this is the key thing, they would be made not to sell, but for use, so there'd be no reason to make it badly, there'd be no reason to have built-in obsolescence, there'd be every reason for it to be designed beautifully, not to have a chip in it, so it all fell apart after a few weeks. So I think, you know, on a positive note, how more positive could you get? I mean, art and beauty are going to sort of thrive, and one of the key things Morris says in his book is that, you know, everybody becomes an artist, you know, in a way. You know, everything you do, you would feel such fulfilment and satisfaction from that, you know, it would be made to be beautiful. And he often talks about time as well. Time is no longer a pressure. So if you're making something, there's no reason you've got to make it quickly. You know, you can take your time and make it well. And that's why his dustman was dressed in silks and so on.
I've got three people on the list now. Is that Tim?
Kevin, yeah.
Tim,
yeah. Just with regard to pre-Raphaelite business and
and women, not to forget Christina Rossetti with that very famous poem, Remember Me, which is beautiful if anyone wants to read it. That's it.
Richard, I think you're next. Yeah. Yeah, and then.
I'll give word to Sandy. Well, Richard, you go first, then. Sandy. Okay. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to say, pick up a couple of things. On this thing about art, artists, I have a friend who lives in Tbilisi in Georgia, and she's a well-known artist. She sells all over Europe. Her paintings disappear, just go, that she's very much in demand. And one of the things, I was a bit shy of asking her initially, but I noticed that she painted, all her works were completely unique, but she painted to a theme which recurred over and over and over and over and over again. And I thought, I was thinking Monet and his, you know, sort of his garden, you know, sort of constantly sort of capturing and changing ideas. And I was a bit shy of asking, but I asked her partner why she did that. You know, was she actually trying to develop a theme? He said, oh, no. That's what she's known for. That's what the market demands. So, you know, I don't know whether she actually enjoyed painting it over and over again, but she was actually, because she had to make a living out of her art. So her art, there was a level of prostitution of her art. If she wasn't doing it, then I can imagine certain creative artists would find that difficult. And the second thing I wanted to say was, sometimes when I'm feeling really depressed about sort of humanity and about the sort of the capacity to sort of really rise above the demands that capitalism makes upon us, I actually think about the sort of Christmas truce in the First World War. And I was researching this a little while ago, and I actually discovered that although that's what's always in the history books, that's not the only example of what was happening. And not only was it not the only example, it was happening all the time, up and down the Western Front, and it was called the live and let live system.
Yeah.
And what you would find is that you know, sort of each side would stop firing on one another during lunchtime so that at least they could get a decent lunch, or when they fired some game birds to sort of supplement their diet, the terrible diet they had, and somebody went out to get the game birds, they wouldn't fire on them. And that there's little stories, like there was one French guy who was cashiered one day because his commander actually heard him shouting across the lines, "We've just been ordered to fire on you. Where do you want us to direct the fire?" And there's a long, long history of this, of actually people firing over their enemies' heads, because human beings are not designed to kill each other. They're actually designed, you know, we have an inhibition to kill, and that's why soldiers have to be actually trained to kill, and huge psychological techniques are now brought to bear in order to force people to do it. And this always actually makes me feel sort of much more good about sort of about human beings, just this fact that in the very extreme of war, that this element of like recognition of a common humanity is still there, and it's not, it has to be forced out of us. So I just wanted to...
No, I couldn't agree more.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the presentation and your story, and I'd like to see it at home. But I would like just to make two comments. Firstly about the welfare system. I think that one of the reasons for me that welfare system doesn't work and there are so many people that abuse it is it exists in a capitalist system, and there are people that replicate within the welfare provision that we have what they see outside. And I think that so long as we have a capitalist structure society that we have, we can have people within the welfare system that abuse it and make it unfair for others. But that's just my personal feeling. The question I'd like to ask is, didn't William Morris have anything to say about how you get from capitalism to socialism?
Yeah, he did. I haven't really gone into that.
Okay.
you know, forgive me, it's a fairly slim volume in all honesty, but even in this time we have, you can't kind of give a reappraisal of everything he did. What he did talk about, which is perhaps my personal feelings, I'm not sure if everybody here would agree with me, he did talk about a revolution, and often a revolution is a term that is used when describing change from one state of affairs, if you like, to another, one form of society to another. My view is I don't think there needs to be a revolution, because a revolution tends to imply an overthrow of a huge sort of system, if you like. I think what we need to get to is a point which is actually rather simple. We just need people, if you like, to look at the present system and not want it anymore. It really is as simple as that. I mean, if you've got enough people, a majority of people that think, well, I don't want this now, you wouldn't have to have a revolution, because most of the police force and army would agree with you too. And I think that would be my ideal. If there had to be a revolution, well, okay, I guess I'd be part of it, I suppose. But I'd rather like it to happen quickly, but in a peaceful way. But he did go into that, and yes, he did, forgive me. Maybe you should, you might have that.
Can I just ask one quick thing?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, how did we get capitalism then? Because we haven't always had capitalism.
There are probably people who can, I'm sure, feel over there is going to give a better answer than me.
Quick question.
If at some point we didn't have capitalism, and then we did, was there a revolution there?
Do you want to feel this one, Bill? Because I think it's beyond me.
Yes, there were capitalist revolutions, and they used state power to create the conditions for capitalism. So you had the growing of markets, then enclosure of land. They took the common land away from people, which forced them to become white immigrant labourers. And there was successive. So what's known as the English Civil War was very much a revolution in terms of the people who held political power, and it drove forward the people who had the interest in expanding commodity relations and capitalist production, and ultimately across the 18th century, and then of course in France you have the French Revolution, the one that everyone knows as a revolution, and that would again brought the middle class to power, and they start using the state engine to get rid of the aristocracy who are getting in the way of their profits, and to also start to build the factories and to discipline the working class. And in News from Norway, he kind of copies the model of revolution with the French Revolution. So there's committees of public safety and a savage civil war that basically goes on for a long time and burns everything down. That's Morris's vision. But he was writing just after the Paris Commune of the 1870s, where the government retaliated by killing tens of thousands to put down the workers' movement in France. So his idea was very much that there would be savage repression and that there would have to be a civil war. And of course, we have a slightly different view, but that was what's in the book.
So we can have a revolution here then. We just be able to, you know, change, introduce laws and make changes to make that happen.
Yeah. Even if it's peaceful, you can call it a revolution. There's no reason why you shouldn't. Yeah, and that's what we normally do. In fact, we do talk about a socialist revolution, even though we see it as something peaceful. Can I just somebody before you?
Just thinking about the arts and crafts movement and what we've been thinking about use of the hands and the synesthetic sense. And maybe one way of thinking about maybe a conflict in socialism, because socialism is going to have its tensions just the same as capitalism does, and maybe a tension in socialism might be between those of us who are like William Morris and want to work with our hands, because without the profit motive you can have any means of production you like, any means of transport you like, so you could bring back pack horses and and all the rest of it. You could use horses. You wouldn't have to. The technology driven by profits. You wouldn't have that. So we could have a Morrisonian kind of society, where everything's made by hand and where
processes are very long and everything, you know, it's all done by hand. Or, on the other hand, you could have a society that's something like the kind of thing that Paddy writes about in Socialist Standard, which is what we're moving towards, where, you know, you could have a chip in your brain and everything could be provided by a technological kind of utopia, technology utopia, and your needs would be satisfied before you even knew you had them. I mean, you could just be some kind of like cube of, you know, like, you know what I mean? You could go completely the other way. So you have this completely kind of science fiction kind of utopia. Now, what would people want? And maybe, obviously, they're exaggerating, but maybe the tension in socialism would be between those two possibilities, both of which would be possible. Are we going to have technology providing everything for us so we can put our feet up and not do anything? Or are we going to do everything with our hands, which is it to be?
Yeah.
And how will that be resolved in a socialist society?
I suspect probably what you'd find would be a combination of a lot of things. I mean, although Morris in his book pretty much sort of, I think, wanted the demise and to get rid of machines. I mean, this is why I think it got a lot of the criticism it did for being this sort of slightly agrarian utopia. But I mean, we're not there now, and I doubt if even we were, we'd probably still not share those ideas. I think there are some types of work that are far better done by machine, which are really unpleasant, say, or very repetitive. But I think the great thing is that in socialism we free up so much more time that people wouldn't all turn into artists, I doubt. Some people may find their satisfaction reward comes from studying or, you know, research or medical work or any number of things, I guess. But I think it'd be a balance, really, at the end of the day, with technology taking on some of the more difficult tasks that human beings don't want to do because it's just too repetitive or whatever.
We'll take Paul now, and afterwards perhaps, if he wants to, Glenn can sum up and we can bring the session to a close. Okay, Paul?
Yeah, it was basically just to concur with everything that, that was said. It was a terrific talk. I would certainly suggest maybe submitting the new news from nowhere for the Standard for publication. I think it would fit really well with that. I mean, let's not forget that Morris was a visionary of his time, you know, with a lot of free thinkers at that moment in the early days of free air thinking. He was also a very wealthy man. You know, anyone who hasn't had the pleasure of visiting his museum in Walthamstow really ought to do so. There's some terrific examples of his work there, his arts and crafts, and his politics, so it's well worth a visit. There was also an excellent film produced, I think it was Tim Pigott Smith, that was in it, which really done his book a whole lot of justice. It was really well made, and every now and again it pops up on YouTube, only for it to be taken down again. And so far as the arts and crafts things go, you know, I mean, there's no doubt about it. Speaking of someone who's a father of a learning disabled child with Down syndrome, she's 22, the therapy that both her and her mother get, I'm not really able to get in as involved as I'd like to. But the therapy and the sense of fulfilment, satisfaction that they get, I'll give them a bit of a plug, incidentally. It's called Mel and Belle Decoupage in Arts and Crafts. My comrades and friends have gone to it on YouTube and such like. And they produce things which I think are absolutely stunning. I will just touch on very briefly, because I know it can be a bit of a can of worms, you know, the idea of welfare, and some people maybe get a little bit more than others are getting wages. I can share that, because up until recently I was a full-time worker, and given my own circumstances, which have changed dramatically, I more or less get roughly the same, perhaps slightly better off, because I don't have the same outgoings as I used to have when I was a full-time worker, because I get more subsidies or more concessions, council tax and things. But what I would say to you is, generally speaking, unless you've experienced it for yourself, it's a fact of life that living with disabilities is a much more costly experience than living without them. I can tell you now that we as a family spend £260 a month just on gas and electricity in order to, I mean, that's like having another mortgage.
Yeah.
Because I also have a daughter with cystic fibrosis who cannot afford to be in a cold, damp, wet house, so we need to maintain those kind of standards. So whilst I can understand, I had to move house about 10 years ago because of neighbours of theirs who were full-time workers, but because we qualify for a mobility vehicle every 3 years, just couldn't get their head around it. It was like, you know, we work full-time, we can't afford a new car every 3 years, how come they get everything? And sure as fate, within weeks of getting it, out would come the screwdrivers and the Stanleys and all the rest of it that we could destroy. So that's the sort of shit that we are up against, a lot of it down to the kind of nonsense that's peddled out there by Jacob Reef's mob and some of his cohorts. So that is just that, you know, another side of the equation. When you're having to live with these things, you do take on a whole new kind of attitude towards it. But certainly in terms of the future, and we've seen ourselves in terms of the new dynamic with this Discord that Comrade Paddy Sharon and a few others have helped to bring to the party. That no doubt has brought a whole new kind of dynamic, as I say, to the party. And for anyone who hasn't heard of it or isn't on it, I would urge them to really get in there. There's a regular, it's a great meeting place for people from all over the world to come together. Paddy, I don't know if Paddy's in the room or not, but if you can identify Paddy, is he not?
No.
Well, one way or the other, if you're interested, we'll get you on. There's no pressure, you know, there's no one has to go on and say or do it. It can just be a great learning curve for everyone to go and hear some of the terrific talks I've given, which our comrade speaker today has given as well, and learn and ask questions. And there's no such thing as a silly question, you know, don't be shy, ask the questions, share your knowledge and your ignorance as well, and only by doing that will we learn. So thanks again for a terrific talk, thoroughly enjoyed it, cheers.
Glenn, do you want to?
Well, I won't say much. I'm sure people want a cup of coffee or something now. So, well, thank you so much, and a couple of your very kind comments. Thank you. All I would say, I mean, really simply, is one thing on the positive way of looking at all this. I think we should go out with a feeling of were socialism to be established, life will be a damn sight more beautiful. I mean, I'm a great believer in. What seems to be happening now is people are becoming very introvert. It's not their own fault, it's the way their work is being prescribed for them. It's the way social media is making them look inside themselves much more. That a lot of that's happening, and it sounds like a cliche, but I do believe, you know, society is really, really losing touch with the natural world. I know that's my sort of thing, if you like, the nature and so on. But, you know, you don't have to look far to find utter beauty out there, and I think the great thing about socialism is that beauty would have a value, and it would have a value to people, and it would make life a damn sight better, basically. But thank you anyway.
Thank you.